What does VA mean to me?
A place for my daughter to call home. Thanks to the VA home loan.
A new lease on life. The best healthcare team I've ever had is here at VA.
And education and the opportunity to open doors I never thought possible with my GI Bill.
The financial support I need to manage the disabilities I develop because of my service.
Get what you earn. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.
Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, we'll learn more about efforts to help veterans in Central Ohio find jobs. Jay Fox will also speak with an expert about healthcare in our community, and he'll have a conversation with an author about family court reform. Plus, Doug Petcash from Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up, on Columbus Perspective.
There are over 60,000 veterans in Columbus, and when you expand that to include all of Franklin County, that number jumps to almost 100,000. With federal workforce cuts and the recent government shutdown, job insecurity is hitting families across the country. And for the military and the veteran community, these challenges compound an already difficult transition from service to civilian life. Disabled American Veterans, DAV, is stepping up to help. And Marine and Air Force veteran Dan Clare joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about how DAV is helping and how you can participate. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for looking out for Ohio veterans, Jay.
Well, it's a priority. For those who may not know, Dan, what is Disabled American Veterans?
DAV, we are founded in Cincinnati, Ohio. We're a nonprofit, a charity, 100 years old. We help provide a lifetime of support for veterans of all generations, their families, caregivers, and survivors. We help about 1 million veterans every year. That's getting health care, getting the benefits that they've earned, representing them on Capitol Hill. And then there's the employment piece, which is really important to us, making sure that they have a meaningful post-military mission.
So how do you help veterans connect to employment and, if they're so inclined, entrepreneurship opportunities?
Yeah, we have a career fair program. We do about 100 career fairs a year. Many of them are virtual. And that's the biggest thrust of the effort to make sure that veterans are able to connect with employers who want to hire them. We also have a program called DAV Patriot Bootcamp. That's an entrepreneur program where we're providing service members, veterans, and spouses who are founders, who have businesses. We give them access to mentors. We provide them with educational programming, and then we give them a network of experts and peers who are going to help them innovate, help them build their businesses.
Now, I've been to a lot of job fairs as a journalist, covering them in my career. What makes the DAV job fair different from a regular job fair?
I think the main difference is that the people who are there to hire veterans, hire family members, hire spouses. They're not, you know, they're holding down a table, which is sometimes the case, sadly, at job fairs. These are people who want to hire veterans. Our next event, November 25th, from noon to four, is going to be really exciting. You're going to see a level of employers that's pretty unique. AT&T, Department of Energy, Wells Fargo, Hearst Media. There's all kinds of companies offering jobs. And veterans bring a wide range of different talents and experiences. So we want people to get involved, check it out, and be ready to go there and succeed.
Now, is that a virtual deal or is that in person somewhere?
No, this is a virtual career fair at jobs.dav.org. You can learn more about, sign up for it, learn about the opportunities that are out there.
What happens if I'm in Central Ohio and I want to restrict my search to Central Ohio? Is that how does that work?
I mean, you're going to look at jobs that are in your area. So you're going to look at Central Ohio careers. There's plenty of them out there. So you just have to narrow your search a little bit. Doing that virtually is easy. You can. The other nice thing, of course, is that you can do it from home. So, for disabled veterans, that eliminates one more barrier sometimes to them connecting with an employer. And those connections and even some of the interviews that they do where maybe they don't get hired right away with that company, they give the veteran the building blocks for their next step in their career journey.
Now, let's go back to Patriot Bootcamp for a minute. How often do you do these? Are these quarterly or annually?
We do about 100 career fairs a year. The virtual career fairs are ongoing, and we visit a lot of military communities where we're connecting with people moving out. We do events, and we'll be in Columbus in March 5th. But I don't want people to wait. I don't think it's a good idea. It doesn't look good that you're waiting till after the holiday sometimes to start a new career. So we're trying to get as many people involved as possible in that virtual career fair, November 25th.
Okay. And on the Patriot Boot Camp for the entrepreneurs, is that the same or do you do those less?
We do fewer of those. We do about 3 cohorts a year. There you're talking about 2.5 days of intensive programming. Our next event there is February 11th through 13th in Myrtle Beach. We do them here in the Cincinnati area as well, which is closer. But our next event here in Cincinnati is in October next year. But people travel from all over to attend these events because of the value and the quality of the network that they're going to get coming out of those events.
What's an example of someone that should get involved in terms of an entrepreneur in these Patriot boot camps? This is exciting.
Yeah. I mean, we're looking at founders, people who have already taken some steps with their business and are ready for that next step, ready to make their business grow. I think of some of the companies that are involved. One of the guys had invented an inflatable wetsuit for children because he had a friend who'd lost a child to drowning. Another one is a veteran, Julie Sargent. She has a company that helps with first responders in natural disasters. And so she lines up just behind the front lines to keep people from having to be medically evacuated for immediate first aid and needs like that so that they can get back into the fight to put out forest fires or whatever natural disaster they're facing. So one thing in common with all of these veterans and all of their missions is that it's very focused on community growth and community support and in answering some of the challenges that we face as a nation.
Now, is this like a Shark Tank situation where we have to connect an idea with funding and someone to help guide us through a business plan and growth?
Well, it's kind of like that. There is a Shark Tank style competition at the end where folks who sign up can compete for $10,000 and non-dilutive funding, but it's really about building blocks. We don't want people to feel like they're coming necessarily to a competition, but we do want to make sure that business is accessible to them. So funding is a major discussion that we're going to have. Branding, marketing, sales, team building. We're looking at the main issues that veterans tell us all the time are their barriers to success, and we're giving them workarounds. We're helping them succeed.
Let's say that a business owner or a board of a company says, we're going to take 2026 and we are going to make it a priority to hire veterans this coming year. What is the first step that they need to do to get connected to participate in these activities?
I mean, certainly jobs.dav.org is a great place to start. We have resources for employers there. We have an employer hiring guide there. I mean, first, I'd tell you as a company, you're making a good decision. You're going to get a lot of great people if you're focused on veterans. The next thing I would say is you can look at one of the great ways to get involved is you can become a DAV Patriot employer, and that's at jobs.dav.org. Where if you can show us that you're making a commitment to hiring veterans, retaining veterans, and supporting veterans in your community, we're going to give you a seal, and that's going to tell other veterans and spouses who come to your human resources page looking at or your job board that you support veterans, and that's just going to be one more step to help you attract and hire that great talent that's out there in the veteran community.
Now, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to give us just one of your favorite examples of one of your program success stories.
I mean, I think about there's an Army infantryman named Chris Peer. He attended a job fair kind of on a whim. He hadn't really, he was actually planning a skiing trip at the time, but He was dealing with some pain from his service-connected disabilities. He goes to a job fair, speaks to recruiters, and he gets an apprenticeship. And sometimes apprenticeships don't sound like a great thing, but for him, this was at a national bank. A year later, he's hired into a full-time position, and he's on his way to an exciting career that he probably never thought would have been possible without a DAV job fair.
Now, let's give our listeners that website one more time so that whether they're looking for a job or whether they're providing a job, they know where to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Jobs.dav.org. If you're a veteran and you need help with benefits, if you want to sign up to be a DAV Patriot employer, just check us out at jobs.dav.org.
All right. We want to thank Dan Clare from Disabled American Veterans, better known as DAV, for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Healthcare is among the most important issues concerning Central Ohio residents right now. The fall government shutdown brought increased anxiety over how fragile our healthcare insurance system is and concerns as to what the future will look like for affordable care. Maddie Toomey is the communications director for Project Our Care and joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Welcome.
Thanks, Jay. Thanks so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. Maddie, is the real issue surrounding health care in the United States? Who should pick up the tab?
Well, no, the real issue is health care. That's what we're talking about today. And in the summer, Congress passed a bill cutting $1 trillion from Medicaid in the Affordable Care Act. And now we're seeing the fallout from that. So we're looking at a fight over, you know, are we going to stand up for everyday Americans, everyday people from Ohio, or billionaires and big corporations?
How does healthcare tie into the concept of welfare?
I think that healthcare is an issue that touches every single person. So, you know, whether or not it's, you know, someone calls it welfare, it is for the welfare of every single person. I don't know a single family that it doesn't reach. And, you know, the issue that we're talking about is whether or not premiums are going to spike for over 580,000 people in Ohio. And not only that, but if those premium hikes do go through, it'll touch every corner of our healthcare system, whether it be rural hospitals, people who get their health insurance coverage at work like me. Costs are about to spike because of this bill that was passed over the summer.
Why has the country been so divided on the issue of the Affordable Health Care Act? What are the pros and cons from a non-biased perspective?
In my opinion, the country is not divided. Polling shows that this is one of the few areas that voters are extremely, extremely united. And voters want Congress to extend the tax credits under the Affordable Care Act. They want Congress to act to lower their healthcare costs, to protect coverage, to reverse the cuts that happened over the summer. And it's actually just the lawmakers in Washington who are divided. And so this is why this issue, I believe, is getting so much attention, is because it's one of the few issues that we can look around at our neighbors and say, we're all on the same page.
When government funding is suspended or comes to an end for any particular reason, what impact does it have on programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and even Affordable Health Care Act plans?
So the government shutdown, those are our healthcare programs are largely deemed essential, and I'm not a policy expert, so I'm sure someone could tell you some very technical aspect on how these cuts are affected. At the end of the day, government workers are not getting their paychecks, and that is hurting families all over the country. And essential government programs are you know, pausing, and you know, I've seen headlines about how that's hurting research and you know, vital. You know, it'll hurt the National Park Services. And so everyday operations we've all come to rely on are coming to a halt. But this fight is so, so important because it's really about stopping premium hikes. So at the end of the day, the American people just want Congress and the president to protect our health care. And everyone wants the government open. It's absolutely, we want to end this government shutdown. We want to end this health care crisis. And that's what the people want.
Here in Central Ohio, we tend to try to find unusual ways to solve problems. Can the emerging trend of membership-based or concierge physician service assist in delivering better care to needy populations?
Well, I would say I don't know enough about that to answer what that could do, but people need health care coverage. I mean, we're in a system where we need health insurance. And so if we're talking about, over 15 million people across the country losing their health insurance, we're talking about providers not getting paid. So, no matter what the model is of provider, we need doctors and rural hospitals to get reimbursed for their services. So we need to keep people covered. Under the last administration, we saw a record low uninsured rate, and we want to keep up that momentum. We want to make sure everyone across Ohio and across the country has the health care that they need. They can afford it, and the coverage to go see a doctor when they get sick.
You've mentioned rural health care four times so far in this conversation. Why is rural health care more at risk than, say, the big cities?
That's a really good question. I would say that rural hospitals are just more at risk. So Protect Our Care is doing a project called Hospital Crisis Watch, where we're tracking hospitals that are at risk of closing or have already closed because of the healthcare cuts that took place over the summer, because they're projecting, less and less income over the years. And so we're seeing a huge, huge impact on rural healthcare providers, especially. And, I just took a look at Ohio this morning, and there's at least, I would say, a dozen hospitals at risk or have already closed on our map. And not all of that to say that it's only rural. Urban hospitals are certainly being hit too, but rural hospitals especially rely on funding from Medicaid, and Medicaid was hit hard with this new bill.
I have a friend who lives in Norway. They have free health care. So do some friends of mine in Canada. Why is the concept of free national health care so abhorrent to so many people in the United States?
That's a really good question. I think our system has just become too complicated. And so it's really hard for people to all kind of get on the same page of, how to get there. But, most people I talk to every day from all over the country do want affordable health care. Everyone wants to get to the same place. It's just, differences on how to get there. But at the end of the day, the way to get there is not to rip away people's health care coverage. It's not to double their premiums. It's not to cause healthcare chaos and fire workers at HHS and cause, general uncertainty on where people are going to get their care. So
not to mention what they need care for or what they're taking and how it can affect them.
Yes, absolutely. And, at the same time, there's so many different issues that come into play here where, prescription drug costs are still skyrocketing. There's still so many things going on that are very, very obvious to stop. And like I said, it's extremely popular across the political spectrum to address these different things.
One of the things that we face as journalists in the media industry is accusations of bias. And I always look for non-biased, fact-based places where people can be directed for information. So if you were approached by somebody who has heard this interview and they said, I really would like to do a deeper dive and learn more and get some information, where would you send them?
Well, in addition to coming to protectourcare.org, I would also encourage folks to look at the Kaiser Family Foundation. They do a lot of really, really good work in terms of, what will my premium look like if these tax credits get ripped away? How many people in my community rely on the Affordable Care Act or Medicaid? So if you want to look at the hard numbers and see just who's going to be impacted, that would be my first suggestion.
All right. We want to thank Maddie Toomey for sharing her time. She's the communications director for Protect Our Care. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
For more than three decades, family court attorney Meg Groff, based in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, worked 60-hour weeks, often for little or no pay, defending the rights of the poor and abused women and their children against a legal, social, and economic system cruelly stacked against them. In her new memoir, Not If I Can Help It, A Family Lawyer's Battles for Justice for Victims of Domestic Violence and the Poor, Groff tells the stories of some of her most memorable clients. These are brave women with few resources who fought for justice with amazing resilience, determination, and grace. It's our pleasure to have her now on Columbus Perspective Magazine. Good morning.
Good morning.
The book was a fascinating read. How did your legal career lead you to become the defender of the poor and the abused?
Well, you know, initially I planned after college to become a psychologist, but one night while I was still in college, in the middle of the night, a young woman knocked on my door frantically, clearly abused, beaten. She was hysterical, saying that she had, that her ex-boyfriend had come up to where she was hiding, at a house that she was hiding in, and had grabbed their infant, who was nursing, and beaten her and fled. And I called the police, and they said that, and she told me that she called the police, and that they said when he was breaking in the door, and they said that it was not an issue that they were involved with because he had as much right as she did to the child, and it was just a domestic. I thought that there had been some misunderstanding, but there wasn't. And I sort of decided then that that's what I wanted to do, that I had not realized how terrible the legal system was for women and children, and that that's what I wanted to do with my life.
Now, doesn't legal aid provide these types of services?
Many legal aids do represent in custody and protection from abuse, but legal aids are very underfunded. They've just recently had their funding cut tremendously by this administration, and they only can represent a very small percentage of people that are income eligible. So many of them don't handle custody because it's very time-consuming and difficult kinds of cases to handle in these matters. And so I would say that the amount of the chance of getting representation is small.
So when it comes to divorce and custody matters, what obstacles are women who have less means than others now facing?
Well, first of all, there's a question of just if you can't afford a lawyer, you're very much at a disadvantage. And of course, there's a question of being able to afford a good lawyer. So there are some legal aids that represent, and legal aid lawyers tend to be good. But going in by yourself is a very dangerous situation. And many times that's where poor people, end up in civil court or family court. In criminal cases, if you're facing jail time, you have the constitutional right to a lawyer, but that's not the case when it's not a criminal matter. And the system is just controlled by misguided laws. They're uninformed and biased. There's a lot of misogyny. And there's in custody, there is, well, I could go on.
Well, and that's what I'm driving at, Meg, is for our listeners to understand the depths of the problem, maybe you could give us just a brief précis of a case where the law failed to protect a victim.
Yeah. I was very successful in my cases, but that was because I fought so hard, and I wasn't charging people, and I was willing to appeal bad decisions and things like that. So it's very hard to convince a court to protect women and children correctly. And I had one case where my client had been raped by the father of the child. She had become pregnant as a result, and she was a child when she was raped. And he was suing for custody of, for partial custody of the child, who was conceived as a result of the rape. And believe it or not, it was not an easy case to win. That's the kinds of things that happen.
I mean, that's unconscionable. My question, I guess, hearing all of this, and I'm sure our listeners are thinking the same thing, is this calls for legal system reform. What court
exactly.
reforms are needed to help protect the rights of women and children going forward?
First of all, there needs to be an understanding that women and children should be believed when they testify to what's happening to them. Children, there's so many myths about children. There is, in custody, there is a strong belief that it is important for children to have ongoing and consistent contact with both of their parents. Sometimes that's written into the law in some states. You know, every state has different laws. Your state, Ohio, has two provisions in terms of what they consider to be the best interest of child, that the child, that involves this ongoing consistent contact. You know, which parent is more likely to encourage it, are the parents, which parent is more friendly to the other parent. And when a parent knows that the other parent is abusive, it's very hard to come out ahead on that factor of encouraging the other parent to have contact. The belief that children must love their parent, both parents, and if they don't, it's because the other parent brainwashed them into thinking that they were being abused. Those kinds of things are what we need to change. So we want to have all the custody laws across the country put the safety of children first.
And need to be federal mandates, not something that overrides the state.
Well, no, states all, unfortunately, each state has the right to have its own laws in family court. And so we have to do it state by state.
That's a lot of states.
That's a lot of states. We have 8 so far that have adopted what we call Caden's Law. Caden's Law was named after a child actually from my county in Pennsylvania who was bludgeoned to death by her father when she was in his court-ordered custody, despite the fact that the judge had been informed of how dangerous a person he was. He had a great history of abuse. She was ordered to be in his custody. She was 7 years old. He beat her to death. And we have 8 states so far. Some of them have different names because there are many children have been killed by an abusive parent.
Now, does the judge in these cases face any kind of responsibility or criminal charges if something like that happens? Are they aiding and abetting?
No. No. In our case, the judge was just moved from family court. He was taken out of family court and put in civil court. That's all that happened with that. So we want the law to prioritize the safety of children, to consider past evidence of abuse, and if it finds that, to either not have custody or to have supervised custody, to have safety measures put in place. We want experts who testify to be appropriately qualified in understanding the dynamics of domestic violence. And we want the judges and court personnel to be trained in evidence-based training on domestic violence and its effect on children.
We just reported that in the state of Ohio, fatalities from domestic violence cases this year are 38% higher than they were last year. That is a significant jump.
Yeah. And they're always incredibly high. I mean, there was a study done by the Center for Judicial Excellence that found that in a 15-year period ending in 2023, just under 1,000 children were murdered by a parent involved in a custody litigation separation situation, almost always by the father. And yet they keep thousands and thousands of children are court-ordered into the unsupervised custody of an abusive parent. Judges just can't accept the idea that a parent can be abusive in that manner.
Mm. How long did it take you to write the book?
About two years, I guess, about 2 years. I did it on and off, some chapters ahead of time, but I always meant to write this book, because whenever I would tell people about my cases, they would be flabbergasted. They wouldn't be able to believe it. And I thought someday when I have the time, I would write a book about it and talk about the cases and show people so that they would understand and maybe take action.
Well, when I read the book, I had to take a lot of pauses because some of the stories are really heavy. The book is called Not If I Can Help It. The author is Meg Groff, and it is available online and at bookstores near you. Meg, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you.
And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
2025 was certainly a big year in politics. President Donald Trump holding office in the first year of his second term. And here in Ohio, we had two brand new U.S. senators, Republicans Bernie Moreno and John Husted. Now in 2026, Husted is up for re-election. Ohioans will also be choosing a new governor, as Governor Mike DeWine can't run again because of term limits. Today, we're focusing on those big races in 2026. Three Republicans are running for governor in the May primary. They are biotech entrepreneur and former presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy, who has been endorsed by President Trump and the Ohio Republican Party. Also, businesswoman and former Morgan County School Board President Heather Hill, and Casey Putsch, an automotive entrepreneur and the founder of the Genius Garage charity. The only Democrat in the race is former Ohio Department of Health Director Amy Acton. She guided Ohio through the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. The race for U.S. Senate pits Republican Senator John Husted against former Democrat Senator Sherrod Brown. Governor DeWine appointed Husted, the former lieutenant governor, to replace Vice President J.D. Vance in the Senate. Brown served three terms in the U.S. Senate before losing to Republican Bernie Moreno in 2024. The winner of this race in November will have to run again in 2 years. Republican strategist Terry Casey and Democratic strategist Morgan Harper joined me recently to break down the big races. I just want to start off with getting your thoughts on how you feel your party is positioned heading into 2026. And Morgan, we'll start with you.
Yeah, well, you know, we've had a rough road as Democrats in the state of Ohio for a lot of these statewide races, but I think there are some opportunities. I mean, of course, we're seeing that there's a lot of discontent with the presidential administration and how it's doing on the economy, and the Republican Party of Ohio is very much tied to those MAGA outcomes and President Trump. And so I think if Democrats can run races that do focus on issues around affordability, that are building off of some of the grassroots energy, there's a chance to be successful, but it's by no means a guarantee.
And Terry, how about for you? How do you feel the Republican Party is positioned heading into 2026?
Well, I think things are coming together in terms of not having any bitter primaries at the top for Senate or governor, and the rest of the ticket's pretty well shaped up, so I think things are moving ahead well. Obviously, the good news is Ohio's not the same state as it was in 08 or 12 when Barack Obama won this state. Things have changed significantly in Ohio, and national Democrats have pretty much given up on the state. When they don't put money in, that makes turnout harder for the Democrats.
Well, let's talk about the big races here, the governor's race and the Senate race, starting with the governor's race. And Terry, for you, how do you see this shaping up now heading into actual election year?
Well, good or bad, both candidates for governor are new and, in a way, fresh faces. So, in a way, experience doesn't matter quite as much. But the real question is, where are you going to take the state for the future? And Dr. Amy Acton not only has the baggage from the COVID shutdowns, the loss of learning in the schools on her neck, but there's also the question, she says she's for change, but can't answer any questions in terms of change to what, how are you going to pay for it? And by the way, she now says she's going to fight inflation as governor of Ohio. And last time I checked, governors in the Ohio Constitution don't have a power to adjust prices at the gas pump or the grocery store. But she could make the parks free, but, oh, the parks are already free. So how are you going to save money for Ohioans if you're candidate for governor? So as governor, people want to know, how are you going to run the state? What's your real vision? How are you going to do it? How are you going to make it happen?
And how about for you, Morgan? How do you see this shaping up so far?
Well, I want to pick up on something that Terry said earlier, too, about how a lot has changed in Ohio. Yes, political winds have changed, but also the economic outcomes for a lot of Ohioans have changed for the worse. And so I think that is why we're seeing some of these more outsider candidates that don't necessarily represent the establishment that are going to bring this vision of I'm going to be different. And in terms of the power that the governor has to do something about it, well, let's look at something like utility prices. I mean, I think that is clearly an area that is controlled by the state government. And so we're starting to see Amy Acton talk a little bit about that. I think there's room for her to lean even more into topics like that and force Vivek to say what he's going to do differently from prior Republican administrations that have shown no interest in checking the utility monopolies that are driving up electricity costs for Ohio consumers.
What do you think the tone's going to be like as we move into 2026?
I think this is a very interesting time politically. And you know, when we look at Amy Acton's race, and I do think Sherrod's race is also relevant here. I mean, in terms of money coming in, Sherrod running is going to give a lot of those national donors reason to pay attention to Ohio and put money in. But I think that we are going to see these candidates have to navigate ever-changing political waters. And so it's going to be important for Amy Acton to be responsive to what's happening nationally and some of the messaging that's going on around issues of affordability, but also keep it really focused on Ohio. People want change in the political tenor, and so I think she's talking about things like kindness and bringing people together, but people are also angry, and we have to be real about that. We've seen some of that messaging coming out of Vivek Shop and talking about the future, but we need to be really clear about the villains we're identifying, those that she and Sherrod will take on in the positions of they're successful.
What do you think, Terry, as far as tone? Is this going to be nasty? Is it going to be civil? A mix?
Or it might be more nasty and then more nasty and more nasty, because unfortunately the tone in politics these days is not always kind and gentle. And then there you got the variable of you have people nationally, particularly from D.C.
The PACs and whatnot.
They come into Ohio and they think one size fits all and they don't understand the differences in Ohio or the regions of Ohio, because Cleveland and Cincinnati are both heavily Catholic. They both have NFL teams, but they're very different in terms of their heritage, more German Catholic in Cincinnati, more Southern, whereas Cleveland is more of an interesting ethnic mix of Eastern European, African American, a lot of other kind of things. So this is a different state, and unfortunately, national people on both sides overplay their hand, get overly nasty and negative, and that doesn't always work in Ohio.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be important. Nastiness towards whom, right? And so there's certainly critiques that a lot of us on the Democratic side have of someone like Vivek Ramaswamy, John Husted. But I think it's important that we focus a lot of our negativity at some of the drivers of the negative outcomes for Ohioans. A lot of the large healthcare corporations, hospital systems that have been driving up costs that have made it really hard for Ohioans to do simple things like give birth to a baby near where they live. And so that's going to be important. The other thing I would note is that elections, as we both know, are won by people turning out to vote for you. And it's really important for the Democratic Party in both of these races to remember that our success runs through the big cities at this point. Yes, you want to speak to all of Ohio. Yes, you need to travel all over the state. But if either of these candidates is going to be successful, they need to have super big turnout in Columbus, in Cleveland, in Cincinnati. And a lot of that also has to consider what a lot of Black voters are looking for.
And Terry, you and I talked actually before this show even, that you mentioned how important you think turnout is going to be.
Well, John Kasich became governor in 2010 because of the depressed Democrat failure to turn out in urban minority areas like in Cleveland, Cuyahoga County. But it was also true in other years, too, because, again, 08 and 12, when Obama won big, was very different. And if there isn't excitement among younger minority voters, urban voters for the Democrats, they're almost sunk before they even start. And the Republicans, it's not always certain also, because in a non-presidential year, does all of the Trump base want to turn out? And then there's ticket splitters, what motivates them. And by the way, on utilities, one of the changes in Ohio is now Ohio used to generate most of its electricity plants in Ohio or on the Ohio River. Now we're part of a 13-state grid, which makes it even more complicated in price dealing with New Jersey, Pennsylvania, other areas. So it's complicated to figure out how to solve some of these problems.
Looking now to the Senate race, how competitive do you think it's going to be between Senator John Husted and longtime former Senator Sherrod Brown?
I think it's tricky. I mean, we saw in the last race that Sherrod was running that he was able to do better than, you know, the national presidential race top of the ticket. But it's still a gap to fill. And I think one of the tricky messaging challenges that he'll have is, you know, anything he's suggesting that he's going to do, there will be the question of, well, you had time to do it before. How is now going to be different? In addition to the fact that John Husted's in a position where he can kind of maneuver rhetorically to seem more progressive than he maybe is. We've already seen some signs of that. He's now committing to supporting extension of ACA subsidies in some interviews. And I think that we will see more of that. It's the same dance that we're seeing Trump do on the national level.
Yeah, he did actually tell me in one of those things that it was, you know, it's possible for, you know, to support some type of extension. So we'll see how that goes as these negotiations.
And this is where it's important for, I think, both of the Democratic candidates, but definitely we're talking the federal level and some of the healthcare proposals. So how is Sherrod Brown going to outflank John Husted? If his position is that he, even if he's waffling in it, that he supports ACA subsidies, what's your health care plan? And how is it going to be a better version of what a lot of Americans are looking for?
And in the Senate race, one of the other unique factors is in last election, 24, Sherrod Brown and his opponent spent a total of $500 million in the campaign. Huge amounts of national money came in. But will the national money come into Ohio in 26 because it's only for a two-year term, because whoever wins has got to run again in 28. So who has the money? Who has the messaging? And also, Sherrod still has the problem. He had so many decades in Congress and in the Senate. There's a whole lot of issues we're facing today, including the last 4 years as him as a senator, what happened with inflation. There's a lot of issues that can be blamed back to Sherrod. And is his brand as fresh and new for the 21st century compared to Husted, who's new to the D.C. scene?
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.
I was a soldier, then a veteran, a husband, and a father. And with my VA home loan, I'm a homeowner. No down payment required and no PMI. Build your future with the VA home loan. Get what you earn. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for this hyper amount of benefits mentioned here.